This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Time. There's nothing more valuable. It's what drives everyone to make the most of every moment. We celebrate living large in the now. In a city where time disappears, we create experiences that electrify the soul and memories that will last forever. We go big. We go all night. And here, everyone is invited. So get loose and get loud.
This is Circa. You'll have the time of your life.
Hello and welcome to the Rushmore Conti Show presented by the Sporting Tribune on the Mightier 1090 ESPN Radio in Southern California, 98.5 The Bet in Las Vegas, and the Hawaii Sports Radio Network, 95.1 FM and AM 760 in Hawaii. A lot to get into here on a Wednesday. Let's not waste any time. Let's bring in from the Sporting Tribune, Grant Mona, Jake Dicker. Grant, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing so well today. The Dodgers did the impossible last night, so I'm in high spirits. The Stanley Cup final has been pushed to 6 games, and that's something that the Dallas Mavericks couldn't do in their finals, so we're doing pretty good.
Jake, I'm going to start with you there and then go back to Grant. The Dodgers coming off some really tough news in terms of Mookie Betts being out for 2 months, basically, you know, timeline confirmed by Dave Roberts, also timeline said originally by Dr. Grant Mona. We had him on the show, and he said, like, listen, that's probably a 2 month injury. So, no surprise there. Yoshinobu Yamamoto, a little bit more of a concern because there's no like concrete timeline there. But again, the hope is that he'll be back this season. Long-winded way of saying, bad news for the Dodgers. They do follow that up last night with their win of the season. Just an incredible comeback performance. Jake, your thoughts?
Anything's possible when you're playing in Coors Field. So, I mean, them to put up 7 runs last night in the ninth, Jason Hayward pinch hit grand slam, Teoscar Hernandez maybe should have handed the Rockies the win on a check swing there. I know Jake Cave out in right field was not too happy when that ball flew over the fence to give the Dodgers the lead, started screaming from right field to the first base umpire. That being said, the Mookie injury and the Yamamoto injury are real concerns. The Mookie injury, not as much, just because we know he'll be back. And there could be some silver lining in getting him in October with less miles on his body. That's the one way that I'm spinning this as a positive. The Yamamoto thing's a little bit more concerning. They had already pushed back his start 2 days. Says he feels his tricep tendonitis tricep tightness in warmups, and not enough to not make the start. Goes out there, throws an inning, velo's down. The issue with pitchers is he's going to take time off before he picks up a baseball, and everything you do up until that point, you are hoping is the right move, but you don't really know how the arm's going to respond until you pick up a baseball and start throwing, and that's not going to happen for a couple weeks, at least a month, I would assume. And, you know, worst case scenario is he comes back, it doesn't heal the way he hopes it will, makes a start, hits the IL again, and has surgery. That's absolute worst case scenario. Best case scenario is he takes a couple, you know, months off and is ready to go in October. And with the Dodgers' depth of starting pitching, even with the, you know, obscene amount of injuries that they've had, Bobby Miller coming back, making a start tonight, we're going to get Clayton Kershaw back at some point. Tyler Glasnow, knock on wood, has been healthy. So there are going to be guys that can come in and fill those roles, especially in, you know, a weaker National League, as we've seen and compared to, you know, years past. I don't think that this injury is anything that's going to have major implications on the Dodgers, you know, missing the playoffs or anything that's going to happen down the line. At the end of the day, Yamamoto is throwing once every 6th day. So it shouldn't really impact things that much. And there are guys that are going to come back in and fill those slots. So as much as it sucks to see those guys go down and, you know, a day after another, the reinforcements are there. And I think that they've got enough on that roster, at least now, to kind of get by in the regular season. If either of these things trickle into the playoffs, it's a major issue. But for now, I think it's okay.
Grant, before you talk about what you wrote in the Sporting Tribune as the win of the season, talk to Dr. David Chow about this, and he agreed with you. He said, listen, I'm not concerned about Betts because he will be back. I know that for certain. That's just a timeline thing. With Yamamoto, he was more concerned of A, if he will be back, and B, if he does come back, what kind of pitcher they will be, what kind of pitcher will take the mound. Again, we kind of have seen that with Buehler. Now, Buehler is different, right? I mean, you're coming back from Tommy John surgery, it's not the same thing, but this is not a broken hand, 2 months, you'll come back and you're the same player. With Yamamoto, there's real concern there. So on both fronts, Grant, your thoughts?
Yeah, the structural part of it is always what scares me, especially with pitchers. Anytime, you know, you have a guy that has tricep tightness, you worry about it being connected to the elbow. And that's what I was initially concerned about, because we always hear about tightness around the elbow, whether it be bicep, forearm with the flexor tendon, or tricep being connected to a UCL and that being a devastating injury. So while I was kind of surprised that it was a rotator cuff, because usually tricep tightness doesn't really relate to the shoulder, and it kind of connects, so I see it now. Anything structural, whether it's the shoulder with the labrum, the rotator cuff, the flexor tendon, the UCL, that is always a major concern, even if they say it's strained. Look, a strained UCL is still a torn UCL, and a strained rotator cuff means there is minor tears in that rotator cuff, so he's going to have to heal that. Now, I do think that it'll be longer than 2 months. I do think that for Yamamoto, I think best case scenario is probably early September. That's if everything goes well. I mean, if it does push him to middle of September, could we see him in a way more diminished role down the stretch going into the playoffs? He's not probably going to be one of their top arms going out of the gate in the playoffs, if we're being real, if that's the case. But if everything goes well and it's early September, obviously he'll have a little bit over a month to get a few starts in and rehab and get back into playing strength for the playoffs. But obviously it's a big hit, right? I mean, Yamamoto was playing the best baseball of his young MLB career. Like I mentioned, his velocity was going up, and that's why the concern with his velocity being down in that start was so big, was that we kept seeing an uptick in his velocity, especially against the Yankees. He was pumping 98-99, and finally getting to that strength that we saw in Japan. That's what he was throwing in Japan a lot. So it was a big concern. And, you know, look, I know that, you know, Jake mentioned the depth of starting pitching. The starting pitching has been a little bit worse than the bullpen. The bullpen has been fantastic, but Jake is right. This is a reason why you get so many arms in that starting rotation. You're going to get Clayton Kershaw back, and I don't know if he's going to be a starter, an opener, a middle relief, long relief. I don't know, but you're getting his arm back. You're getting Bobby Miller back. And Jake, you and I know this very well. Gavin Stone has been one of their best pitchers all year, and that is something that the Dodgers probably did not foresee coming into the season. He has been one of the best pitchers on the team. So I think that they can be okay while he's out, but obviously it's a big blow.
And one thing I want to add before we move on is, as much as Dodger fans would love to see Yamamoto back as soon as possible, the Dodgers invested 12 years and over $300 million to this guy. This is a long-term investment that is going to, you know, he's going to be a staple of this rotation for hopefully the next decade plus. There is, as much as the World Series is great in year one, this is a long, long-term investment. And I would not expect them, or I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't, you know, make another start this year.
All right, great. Touch on the game again. You did such a great job of really putting into context why this was the win of the season. If you're watching that game late, like in the eighth or ninth inning, like it was incredible. Your thoughts on A, why it was the win of the season. Again, you had previously said that about their first win in New York against the Yankees. Yeah. But what can a win like that do for a team that kind of just coming off getting some really tough news?
Yeah, well, like you mentioned, I was going to hit that right on the head, is that, you know, they just got bad news regarding their leadoff hitter and one of their better arms. And, you know, sometimes that can derail a team. Sometimes that can bring morale down really low. And right after that, the Dodgers went into Colorado and they beat them in game one pretty handily. And in game two, I mean, it looked like, you know, after Walker Buehler had, you know, one of his worst starts of the year, and he was just leaving everything over the plate. He gave up 7 earned runs in 4 innings. Look, it's not easy to pitch at Coors Field. You know, Jake and I know that very well. It's a hitter's ballpark, and that's why a lot of pitchers don't succeed there. But, you know, going late into that game, they were down 9-4. Shohei Ohtani hit a rocket into the right center field gap that was robbed, and it probably could have been an inside the park home run, but it saved at least 2 runs. And at that point, I was like, okay, it's just not their night, right? You're just not going to get back. You're down 5 in a hitter's ballpark. And, you know, I got to give a lot of credit to the bottom of that order. And I mentioned this in my piece, is that without the bottom of the order starting that first rally to get Jason Hayward to the plate with the bases loaded, that other sequence would have never happened with Teoscar Hernandez. Andy Pah has walked. Miguel Vargas had a 2-for-3 game, and he has looked really good filling in for Mookie Betts after being called up after Mookie got sent to the IL. And that bottom of the order gave them a chance. Jason Hayward, fresh off the bench, didn't play all game, in a really big spot to get the Dodgers close, and he hits a pinch hit grand slam after fouling off a couple pitches, had a great at bat. And then you just let your stars take over. Shohei Ohtani gets an opposite field base hit. Will Smith gets called out on a strikeout where he called time, and the pitch was right down the middle, and he gets called out on strikes because the umpire didn't give him time. And at that point, you're saying again, oh my God, so I guess it just really isn't the Dodgers' night. And then the check swing that everyone is talking about, where Jake Cave just goes absolutely bonkers at the first base umpire. It honestly should have been strike 3. It did look like he went on the replay. But the pitch right after, Teoscar Hernandez, it wasn't even just barely over. He launched a 101-mile-per-hour fastball to the right field seats. And it's just like, of course that happens. And I have been a part of many things in my baseball career. I can guarantee you guys this. Every time I made an error in the field, whether it be at short or second, something bad happens right after. It just always happens. So luckily it was in the Dodgers' favor. And I got to give a lot of credit to Teoscar too, because he has been clutch all year. He has been really passionate in that middle of the lineup. He has given them a spark, some energy. And look, this Dodgers team, when they look dead in the water, I know it's the Colorado Rockies, but whenever you can come back from 5 runs down in the 9th inning when your backs are against the wall, that is a huge morale boost. That's a huge confidence boost. And that just goes to show, like, when this team is locked in offensively, they can do things like that.
All right, switching gears to the Lakers, still waiting on who will be the next head coach of the Lakers. It looked like it would be J.J. Redick, and that still could be the case. But a interesting candidate is made available now, Monty Williams. Now, Monty Williams, after just one season with the Detroit Pistons, he was fired on Wednesday. He has 5 years, $65 million left on his deal. Again, he signed the biggest contract for a head coach in league history, which, again, love Monty the man, love what he's done and what he's really persevered to get to this point in his career. He's never won a championship. Now, he did lead the Phoenix Suns to a title. Postgame was one of the more, just to kind of speak to what a great man he is. I mean, he goes into the Milwaukee Bucks locker room, hugs Giannis, congratulates that team. I mean, things like that is what make him a great man. I clearly wasn't a good fit with Detroit, but when you give a coach that kind of a contract, you think that you're going to have him there for the long haul. So the unique thing here is that the Lakers, who historically don't pay big money to a head coach, technically don't have to do that with Monty Williams. Now, you do have to give him a respectable offer. You do have to, treat him like a legitimate head coaching candidate, which unfortunately Jeannie Buss and Rob Pelinka and the Lakers sometimes have not done. Again, we've talked several times about Ty Lue. By the way, Monty Williams was up for the job. Grant, you remember this. I mean, it was Monty and it was Ty. And with both of them, they lowballed them and they said, we're going to pick your assistant coaches. And now they both kind of go on to, you know, good careers. Now, again, with Monty, I don't know who's going to, you know, make Detroit a contending team. That being said, you can't have the season that they had. Jake, I'm going to start with you. Like, there's a reason that they haven't, you know, like made JJ the offer from what we've known. Again, this could change. There's a reason that he's not yet the coach. Now that Monty Williams is available and you could probably, again, the reason you could get him at the same contract is that generally contracts have a buyout, or if you get another deal that, you know, takes off what they have to pay. But again, like, they don't have to give him a big contract. They don't have to give him a Dan Hurley-like contract. If you're Rob Pelinka, if you're Jeannie Buss, you know Monty Williams. Again, he was up for the job when Frank Vogel got the job. Would you call him up and say, hey, listen, we need an experienced coach like you?
I think you make the call. This is a very different situation, but just the way my brain works, this feels similar to when Freddie Freeman just didn't re-sign with the Braves and was one of those things where if it was going to happen, it should have happened by now. Like, kind of the way the JJ thing feels with the Lakers, where it's like, why? Like, what's the holdup? So I do think making a call to Monty makes sense. You know, the financials make sense. You've done your research. You know, you've done the interviews, you've had him in. I mean, it's been a couple of years. I don't necessarily understand what Detroit's doing, right? I know you have the money committed to the guy. He's proven. I know he had one bad year, but he doesn't have a ton to work with. I don't know what Detroit's doing in the sense of whoever you bring isn't going to move the needle further or accelerate the rebuild any more than I think Monty already was. So I don't really understand it from the Pistons' point of view. But now, you know, there's another guy whose name is in the mix. More drama gets added to this Hollywood script that is the Lakers coaching search. And I think at this point, you have to at least make the call because you got to do whatever you can.
Grant, it's a great point, because if JJ was the guy, the fact of the matter is, no matter what we think of the Dan Hurley situation, they gave Dan Hurley the job. Essentially, they gave him a offer. This was after we were basically thought JJ had the job. So Grant, your thoughts, do you pick up the phone and say, hey, Monty, let's talk?
Much like Jake said, I'm so confused about why JJ hasn't been announced yet. The finals are over. Like, you could have announced it yesterday. You know, we have a lot of people saying that he is already the head coach, which I disagree with, and Shams disagrees with as well. But Jake's right. Like, why? Like, there has to be something going on where they're not 100% confident in hiring JJ. And now that you have a veteran head coach, and what I've been asking the Lakers to do for a long time is hire a veteran head coach for a veteran team, right? And my issue with that was that there wasn't really anybody available that really popped out where I could say, okay, well, he can maybe bring, you know, come in and do something. Now you have that name out there. And I know that Monty Williams had a bad tenure in Detroit, but look at what he did in New Orleans with the Hornets, with Chris Paul. Yeah. Look at what he did in Phoenix. I mean, you can say Phoenix never won a title. They got to the finals. Yeah. They were a top seed every single year. When you put a good roster around Monty Williams, he does really good things with it. And the Pistons were just a horrible roster. I mean, they weren't horrible because I still like some of their pieces, but they weren't a contending team. So if I'm the Lakers and I'm on the front office and I'm saying, look, we haven't really officially announced JJ, and I don't think there's a handshake agreement yet, why not give him a call? Let's see if Monty wants to come over to LA and coach LeBron and Anthony Davis. I mean, it could be a situation like Doc Rivers, where Doc Rivers said many times, like, hey, I'm out of coaching. Like, I don't want to coach anymore. I'm good doing TV. But then the Bucks called and said, hey, you want to coach Giannis? And he said yes. So this could be another situation with that, where you can kind of lure him in, even if, like, maybe he just becomes the top assistant for JJ Redick. I think that would be a weird dynamic, but I mean, it could work. Like Jake said, you got to at least try it, right? You got to, I mean, nothing's official. I know that there's reports out there, but nothing's really official. So you're not really doing anything behind anyone's back. You're just doing due diligence. So I would do it, honestly, Arash. I really would.
Yeah. I'm going to pose this question to you, Grant, just because Jake will come back in segment two. But seriously, what the heck are the Detroit Pistons doing? I mean, their season came to a close, well, officially 2 months ago, but realistically 3 to 4 months ago. Like, I am so curious to hear from them, like, why this decision was made, you know, June 19th following the NBA Finals, when, like, you knew what you were, like right before the draft you're making this move?
Yeah, that's the thing about it. It's a pretty big draft for them, too. And I know they didn't get, like, the pick that they wanted, and they didn't last year either. They were probably thinking they were going to get number one or number two. They have number five again, but still, for a young team that's trying to get back to contention and build a really good core, to fire your head coach like mere days before one of the biggest drafts of your tenure, I know that they're bringing in new people in the front office, and that's a big deal for them. But to have to do this now, like you mentioned, Arash, like, why not do it a month ago when the deal was signed with their new front office? Why not do it like right after the season? It's just such weird timing. Maybe Monty had something to do with it. Maybe he was like, hey, like, maybe they can go do the Lakers job. I don't know. I'm not really sure, because he can go to Cleveland too. Cleveland still hasn't hired a coach either. So I'm thinking it was more Monty and not really the front office, because, I mean, when you sign a guy to that big of a deal, like I said with Dan Hurley, when you sign guys to that long of a deal, I think you stick with them a little bit longer. You give them a longer leash. So I think it was Monty. I think he was like, hey, I don't want to be a part of this. Maybe I can find a better opportunity.
It's a great point, because I think he's looking at what's available, and it might not be with Los Angeles. Again, we're bringing that up because we could cover them, but like, he may be looking at Cleveland, and he may say to himself, listen, if you guys want to get rid of me, and maybe they came to like an agreement on a number that made sense for both parties. I'm guessing not. Like, again, when you're on the hook for $65 million, you collect that bag. But what generally happens is, like, if Cleveland, you know, pays 25, then like, Detroit's still on the hook for at least a little bit less. But listen, I mean, this is a fascinating story that we'll keep track of. We're going to leave it there for now. We're going to say goodbye to Grant. We're going to welcome in Steve Karp from the Sporting Tribune, bring back in Jake, talk a little bit more about the Lakers, Clippers, the Dodgers, and so much more when we come back right here on the Mightier 1090 in Southern California, the Bet in Las Vegas, and the Hawaii Sports Radio Network.
Time. There's nothing more valuable. It's what drives everyone to make the most of every moment. We celebrate living large in the now. In a city where time disappears, we create experiences that electrify the soul and memories that will last forever. We go big. We go all night. And here, everyone is invited. So get loose and get loud.
This is Circa. You'll have the time of your life.
Welcome back to the Arash Markazi Show, presented by the Sporting Tribune on the Mightier 1090, ESPN Radio in Southern California, 98.5 The Bet in Las Vegas, and the Hawaii Sports Radio Network, 95.1 FM and AM 760 in Hawaii. Just as a reminder, if you have a question or comment or want to win tickets to an upcoming game in Southern California, Las Vegas, or Hawaii, call our hotline 310-400-0340. All right, let's welcome in from the Sporting Tribune, Steve Karp. Welcome back in, Jake Dicker. Steve, I want to get your thoughts on this. The NBA Finals was not what we had hoped. It was a five-game series, as they say, a gentleman's sweep. The Mavericks avoided the sweep, but they really just extended it by one game. A little bit different in the Stanley Cup Final here. We now have a game six. Connor McDavid really has the stage all to himself. There's no basketball. There's no, you know, like this is his moment to really show why he is considered the best player. Your thoughts on the Stanley Cup Final, and if the Edmonton Oilers can do the impossible, can they come back from being down 3-0, force a game seven, and perhaps even win again? Canada's first Stanley Cup since the Montreal Canadiens back in 1993.
Beat the Kings, by the way.
I know, I remember
Bobby that. Marty McSorley.
The curved stick, the illegal stick.
The illegal stick of Marty McSorley opened the door for the Canadiens to bring the cup to Canada. Will Edmonton do likewise? I still think Florida's the better team. I still think the Panthers will find a way. They're just going the long route instead of the short way, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. They have been dragged back to Alberta by McDavid. as he said he hoped to do. And let's give him credit where it belongs. He has delivered. He has come through. He is the best player in hockey. And he has put the Oilers on his back. And they are following him, his lead. And he's doing a tremendous job. But that said, I still think the Panthers can get this done. And I expect them to do that on Friday.
Jake, I mean, Connor McDavid has broken the hearts of the Los Angeles Kings three consecutive years. So I'd be curious how you're consuming the Stanley Cup final. I mean, are you rooting for Connor McDavid to win? I mean, listen, at least we got sports. At least we got significant sports. So we got a game six of the Stanley Cup final coming up. I think if you're not a Florida Panther fan, you got to be rooting for a game seven as well. Your thoughts, Jake?
Yeah, I've been rooting for McDavid, kind of McDavid more than I have the Oilers this entire time, just because I think it's good for hockey. The frustrating thing in this series is in the last 3 years against the Kings, the Edmonton power play has essentially been a free goal. And I think going into last night's game, they were 1-for-16 in this series, which is just credit to Florida's defense. Kind of going to piggyback off of what Steve said, I think that Florida is the better team here. Edmonton's goaltending is not, and Stuart Skinner's been all right. Not going to hold up to win them two more games in this series. I mean, Matthew Tkachuk is just playing at an all-time high level, and I think that Florida team, they were here last year, came up a little bit short. I think bad experience. I don't think they're going to drop, you know, four straight. So I do expect them going back to Alberta, obviously one of the longest trips. I think the longest flight in Stanley Cup history between the two teams in the final, obviously not ideal. But I do think that they get it done, if not in game six, in a game seven at home.
Steve, we're going to recap the draft because we're both going to be there. But again, the Sphere being the home of the last in-person draft, when we say that, I mean, it's very unique in terms of all the teams, are there. You know, it's not like there's separate war rooms around the country. So this will be the last year that they're doing that. Two-part question. I mean, how well do you think the Sphere will do as the home of the draft? And B, why again are they going away from this? I thought it was always such a fun thing when the GM from the Kings, for example, would get up, walk 20 feet, and propose a trade to another team. I mean, what is the reason that they don't want to have that?
I believe it's a money issue, Arash. Just it's very expensive to bring your hockey ops people with you to a location for 4 days, mm-hmm. where you're better off just staying home and where everything is all set up for you anyway. I mean, I will miss it because even though most media don't get access to the floor, you can still talk to the GM, you can still talk to your head of amateur scouting and get some good stuff. And it's, again, it's been a tradition for as long as I can remember. And I think the kids are the ones who get gypped. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a special moment for these guys. Never going to happen again. So why not be able to share it in person with your family and your friends instead of sitting in your living room or at the rink of your junior team or your college team. You know, it's what kind of makes the NHL special. I mean, you know, the whole jersey thing, you post for the photo, you meet Gary Bettman. A lot of it is good. I think the Sphere will be fine as far as a venue for it, but I'm going to miss it.
Jake, I don't know if you've had a chance to see the Sphere in person. If you haven't, you should. This will be the first sporting event. UFC is holding a card there in September. I don't think it could work for a few sports, but again, I'm still curious, like for UFC, if a fighter is in the middle of the octagon and he sees a projection of himself getting choked out, what that's going to be like. But your thoughts on the Sphere? Again, when Dana White first went in there, he was so enthralled. He said, we're having a card here. Like, I think every league wants to have it do something, whether it's the draft, you know, whether it's like a preseason game. Your thoughts on the Sphere being a sports venue?
It's going to be really interesting, I think, for the exact reasons that you laid out. I don't know. I mean, the big draw of the Sphere is the visual aspect, right? And I don't know how that really leads itself into sports. But, you know, the UFC is going in there. The NHL draft will be in there. So it'll be really interesting to see. I don't know how you put like a basketball game in there. You can't put a baseball game in there for obvious reasons. But I think, you know, it's in Vegas, which I think is a lot of the draw. Vegas is, as we've been talking about for years on this show, developing into, you know, one of the new sports hubs in the country. And I think the Sphere is now the marquee entertainment venue in the country, brand new. So I think it makes sense that all these leagues want to get in there and have their product associated with what is now considered one of the top, you know, venues in the world.
Steve, you grew up in New York when baseball, I mean, when I say it was the baseball capital, I mean, not even close, you know, not only the Yankees, but you had the Dodgers, you had the Giants before they moved west. And there was no bigger star than the Say Hey Kid, Mr. Willie Mays. If you can, just describe for those who, again, were not alive to see him play, who've just seen the highlights, how big of a star and how important he was.
Well, For people who lived in New York in the 1950s, when you had Mays with the Giants playing in Upper Manhattan at the Polo Grounds, you had Mickey Mantle across the river playing for the Yankees in the Bronx, and of course you had Duke Snider playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field. I mean, that was a magical time to be a New York baseball fan. My dad grew up a Giants fan, even though he lived in Brooklyn. My mom liked the Dodgers. I wound up being a Yankee fan because the Dodgers and Giants moved to California by the time I was old enough to know what baseball was. I did see Willie Mays play in person and on TV, not at the height of his career, which was in the 50s, but in the 60s. And toward the end, obviously, you know, when he joined the Mets in 73, he was a special talent. I think the best way to sum up Willie Mays was he made a hard game, baseball, look easy to play.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that and his effortlessly ability to track down fly balls. You know, we all know about the Vic Wertz catch in 1954. We all know about, you know, his hat flying off as he rounded second, going to third. And just the way he played the game, he had a great joie de vivre, if you will, about baseball. It changed his life, and he needs to, you know, he has acknowledged the fact that the black players before him, Jackie Robinson, Larry Doby, Monty Irvin, they opened the door for him. He might have been stuck playing in the Negro Leagues had it not been for those guys. So he always appreciated what the people before him did. That said, the mark he left on the game, you know, very few players could even come close. You know, Hank Aaron certainly is in that conversation. From a more modern perspective, probably Ken Griffey Jr., if you think about guys who could do everything and do it so well. You know, it's a short list. It really, it truly is. And I remember going to Candlestick Park the first time ever, 1970. I was visiting my family in California. My uncle took me, cold, windy, Friday, July night. They're playing Montreal. Guy named Mac Jones hits a ball to right center. Looks like he's going to get a home run. Here comes Willie Mays out of nowhere. Goes over the fence, brings it back in. Robs the guy of a home run. Next day, Willie Mays gets his 3,000th hit. I mean, that's the kind of greatness Giant fans were treated to during the majority of his career. And, you know, if someone wants to say he's the greatest ball player of all time, I'm not going to argue with them.
Yeah, incredible. Jake, like, as a young fan, I know you have a lot of appreciation for the history. You took a If correct me if I'm wrong, did you take a class with Bud Selig when he was teaching?
I did.
What was that like? I mean, again, I mean, obviously former commissioner, but such a historian of the game. What was that class like?
Yeah, that class was the most, incredible experience I've ever had in an academic setting. It was 3 hours a week sitting in a room with 14 kids and, Commissioner Bud Selig just talking about anything and everything baseball, the history of the game. And we talked about Willie a lot. And one of the things that we talked about a ton was the fact that he's an undisputed top five player of all time and somehow is incredibly underappreciated. And I mean, he could do absolutely everything on a baseball field, hit, run, field. I mean, you don't see a lot of plays from 1954 that are still considered some of the best plays in their respective sport. I know now players are so much more advanced. We could say they're more talented nowadays. Willie was so far ahead of his time. And I obviously never got to see him play in person, but I was at the All-Star game in 2007 at then AT&T Park, now Oracle Park. Willie threw out the first pitch and came in onto the field in a car and sat on the back and did a lap around the field. And I think the whole thing may have taken 30, 35 minutes. I would have sat there for 2 hours. I was a 7-year-old kid, and everybody in that park, whether it was the players on the field or the fans in the stands, were acting like there was, there was a living legend in front of everybody there, and everyone just wanted to soak up every single minute they could. Just looking at Willie Mays and seeing the way that the respect that these top players in the sport had for him was unbelievable. That was something that I will never forget. Just one of the all-time greats for so many different reasons. Did it for 25 years, 24 All-Star games, only won 2 MVPs, which is, we can get into that at another time. He should be rivaling Bonds at 7, maybe pushing 8, but he could do it all. And just one of the all-time greats that will be, incredibly missed.
We're going to close out where we begin, Steve. The Detroit Pistons did something very unique today. They fired Monty Williams after just one season. He leaves with 5 years and $65 million plus left on his contract. I mean, when you make a hire like that, it's clearly a long-term thing. They obviously did not have a good season, but again, I don't think anyone expected them to be a playoff team or a contending team. The unique thing about this from a Lakers' perspective is, a potential another candidate for them. Again, having covered Team USA and LeBron and things like that, I mean, do you think it's important for them to bring in an experienced coach like Imani Williams? Again, they wanted Dan Hurley, so there's a reason that JJ hasn't gotten the job yet. Steve, if you're Rob Pelinka, do you pick up that phone and kind of do a Hail Mary and say, hey, Monty, we just heard you're looking for a job. Come on over to Los Angeles.
Boy, I'm not sure he's the right guy. I'm not sure who the right guy is.
Yeah.
I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, because I think as long as LeBron James remains on that roster, it's his team, not your team, whoever the person who coaches it. I mean, Frank Vogel was a perfectly fine coach, okay? And he couldn't last long.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like the turnover, this revolving door of coaches, is creating a bit of a toxic culture with the Lakers. I don't know if you would agree, guys, but I'm not so sure that it would matter who the coach ultimately is. And hey, good for Monty Williams. All this money he's raking, and yeah, all right, you go through some losing, but at least he's comfortably well to do for that losing. At least he got paid pretty handsomely. That Detroit situation is also a mess.
Yeah,
they can't seem to get that thing right. But as far as the Lakers go, yeah, I'm not so sure that I'm calling Monty Williams.
Yeah, I just thought of this question, and I legitimately want to bring it up because people are always joking, like LeBron's the coach. You saw Bill Russell win a championship with the Celtics when he was a player coach. Was that right, thought of as weird or like, I don't think it would happen today, but like it has worked before. How was it accepted back then?
Because Bill Russell had already won a bunch of rings when Red Auerbach was his coach.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there was a smooth transition because all of his teammates on the Celtics respected Russell. They understood He was a brilliant basketball mind who knew the game. And the game was much, much different back then in the late 60s than it is now. I'm not so sure LeBron James could pull off being a head a player coach in 2024. It's such a different game. The management of egos and the way, the style of play, I don't know that he can do it. And I'm not saying LeBron's not a smart basketball player. He is. He's got a high IQ. But I just think there needs to be a separation of church and state, if you will, if you know what I mean.
No.
I mean, players need to play. Coaches need to coach. They just need to find the right one. Okay? And, yeah, you can look inside your own cupboard and say, oh, yeah, we could bake a cake using these ingredients and just have LeBron James do it. I mean, I don't think they would win a championship with him. I don't know that they would be any worse, though.
Yeah.
See, but the Lakers are about rings, just like the Celtics are, okay? And now that the Celtics have passed them, I mean, the Lakers have, they got their work cut out for them if they want to get back on the podium as the top team in the NBA.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing for Lakers fans is that the Celtics are in a position to win again in the future. Jake, I'm going to close out with you because you asked a great question. It was a very simple question, but like, I don't get what the Pistons are doing. Again, I know you want to change up the front office, but like, I don't know how you can at least have a commitment to give Monty Williams one more year. And I think what this does is, like, I don't know who walks into that situation thinking they have any semblance of stability, to your point. And I'll pose the question to you. What the heck are the Detroit Pistons doing?
I don't know. And Grant made a great point in seg one. When you sign a coach to a contract like the Pistons gave to Monty Williams, you're essentially making a multi-year commitment off the bat. You can't put yourself in a situation that the Pistons now find themselves in. And I don't know who you bring in that's going to further your rebuild or accelerate things, you know, that Monty Williams couldn't do in a year or two, or was worth getting Monty out of the door to let someone else come in. It doesn't make a lot of sense. They can't get it right. I do like some of their young pieces. Cade Cunningham is a great young prospect. I think he's going to have a great NBA career. I like Jalen Duren. He's young as can be and is putting up double-doubles, you know, like they're nothing. I just don't, you know, they brought in a new president of basketball ops. They brought in a new GM. And then 3 weeks later, and about a week out of the draft, they get rid of Monty Williams. So I don't know exactly what the plan there is. I mean, my gut instinct right off the bat is they bring in Frank Vogel, which I don't know if that's necessarily a step in the right direction, but I don't know who else you can kind of bring in that's going to try and, you know, calm the waters a little bit and shake things up there.
No, it's a great point. And yeah, when you sign a coach to a contract like that, again, the biggest contract in league history for a head coach, you know, 6 years, you at least think he's making it to year two. I mean, an absolute train wreck of a situation when you fire the coach after year one. And not only that, you do it 2 months after the season. I mean, clearly, if you didn't like him, you fire him once the season is over, and then you begin to look for a head coach at that point. All right, guys, thanks so much. We'll do it again soon, all right? That's all the time we have for today. Let's do it again tomorrow. Until then, this is Arash Markazi saying stay safe. And stay healthy.
Time. There's nothing more valuable. It's what drives everyone to make the most of every moment. We celebrate living large in the now. In a city where time disappears, we create experiences that electrify the soul and memories that will last forever. We go big. We go all night. And here, everyone is invited. So get loose and get loud.
This is Circa. You'll have the time of your life.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, didn't see that coming, and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.